In an age of irrationality, what does it take to persuade people? Hi, everybody. I'm Bob Bowman, Editor-in-Chief, Supply Chain Brain, and this is the Supply Chain Brain Podcast. We like to think of ourselves as rational beings. Give us the facts, we say, and we'll make up our minds. We'll even change our minds. What a lovely fantasy. The truth is that we often make decisions based on anything but logic and facts. Figuring out how to persuade someone to adopt your point of view, especially for complex or highly technical issues, is never easy. Today on the show, we're going to talk about what it takes to persuade people with my guest, Juliet Huck. She is founder of, appropriately enough, the Academy of Persuasion. She'll reveal some of the methods she uses to communicate in a meaningful way that might actually change minds. Her techniques have been deployed in the courtroom and the boardroom, most notably of late in the nation's first virtual patent trial concerning the intellectual property of Cisco Systems. So here is my conversation with Juliet Huck. Juliet Huck, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Juliet, what has 25 years of experience taught you about what it takes to persuade people?
The quickest thing that I can always say is that the number one rule in persuasion is you have to get out of your own shoes and in the shoes of your decision maker. It's surfaced over the years that that is the number one goal, what I call the golden rule, because if we can't start with thinking about how the other person is thinking, then we're in deep trouble. That's the biggest thing I have to say I've learned.
Not easily done. We're all inside our own heads and our own personalities. It's pretty hard to make that leap sometimes, though, isn't it?
Yes, we are. And especially today, we're trying to figure that out.
Would you consider persuasion an art or a science?
I would say it's a combination of both. Like any good storyteller, there's some science behind it, I think, psychologically. But I think it's an art on how someone actually takes it seriously and really refines it. And it's a craft in that sense. So I think there's a little bit of both in there.
What motivated you to found the Academy of Persuasion?
Being in the business for 25 years, I started out as an art director in the courtroom. And I was working with a lot of lawyers. Basically, after looking at jury research and things like that, that I was able to take a look at how people started making decisions. And over those years, I started seeing that wow, everybody makes decisions in very specific ways on do they trust? Can they relate to your subject matter? So I've had probably hundreds of trials that I've worked on. And I started seeing that this formula that was surfacing really applied across so many different arenas. And I started thinking about, wow, this truly could be something that's based on common sense values as well as just the scientific side of it. It applies in sales, it applies in real estate, it applies with your children. I mean, it's how you persuade somebody to get what you need. So I thought, I've got so much experience that it's time to really put together some learning tools. And we're in the process of building that as we speak.
As soon as I'm able to persuade my children of anything, I'm going to let you know. But in the meantime,
I get that a lot.
I can't let go of that title that you just mentioned. You were art director in the courtroom?
Yeah, I was an art director and a creative director for lawyers. So what I would do is a lot of presentation work at the very beginning of my career. Mm-hmm. And then over time, working with the jury consultants and people like that, I started to realize that there was a lot more to it than just doing some charts and graphs. And over time, it's just evolved into being a persuasion strategist because I've seen so many different parts and how things work and different formulas.
It's interesting because, you know, lawyers talk about having to read a jury, and I'm sure that's what you were doing all that time. I mean, voir dire, the questioning part of it is certainly one thing. Their expressions, whether they're bored, whether they're interested, whether they're leaning forward, the look on their face. I mean, all that's got to go into that, right? It's just a huge deal just learning how to read people.
I leave that to the psychologists because they're jury consultants that are trained in that specific area. But just like an advertising agency, you take that research or you take the information from that jury consultant, and then you have to put a story together, right? So based on their research and their findings, then you understand how to pitch a story or how to bring out a story that people can connect with. And that's what I linked on to. I was kind of the bridge between the jury consultant and the graphics people, because it was like we had to bridge that in a place that hadn't really been done many years ago. And I started to see the connection had to be there. So my company, the business model was based on advertising agency and how it was set up, where you take market research for a new product, you find out how people respond to it, and then you figure out what relates, what connects. And so that's what I did. And then the visuals came out of that. So the stories, the themes, the opening statements, trial's a story. It can be a very complicated story. Like on the Enron trial that I worked on, it was a very, very complicated story. What I loved about it was to take that research and then let the psychologists and the big degrees work on how people are reacting to it, but it was my job to develop it.
Can we conclude, at least partially, that the way to persuade people is not through pure rational argument, through laying out the facts, the hard, cold facts, and then hoping that suddenly the scales will fall from their eyes and they'll see the light of your argument? I'm assuming, based on my own experience and the way the world seems to be going today, that that's just not going to work.
It's not working, if you can really look at it. I mean, that's why we kind of are in some predicaments that we're in today, because my mantra is that a story will always include the facts, but the facts will never make a story. And the problem is that we just start throwing facts out and expect people to understand them. And what we forgot about was that some people don't think the way we think. Some people don't learn the way we learn. And so you really have to understand your decision maker in order to persuade someone. And that's the very first step. You got to get in their shoes. So it's a balancing of four elements that I talk about a lot, and which is the first course in the academy, which is, what do you know about your decision maker? Who are you as a persuasive presenter? Have you done your story development? And visually persuasive storytelling, which is a trademark of mine. So those four elements have to balance each other all the time, because otherwise, if one of them is out of balance, let's say you don't really think about your decision maker and it's all about you, it's just, they're going to be turned off. And if you don't put a story together, then you're just throwing out facts and people just, they just don't connect. So, I mean, this is where the media today, I think, is really been difficult.
I like the who are you part, because I think that we tend to, I can speak from experience for myself, we tend to think of ourselves as rational people, but everyone else is irrational. I can't be swayed by emotional arguments and stories. Just give me the facts and I'll make a decision. Of course, I think we're all deluding ourselves into thinking that we're like that too, right? We're just like the people we're trying to convince.
Or we think we know something different and we're trying to push it on them when they can't relate to it. They can't connect to it. I mean, the best example I can go into is just go into a jury box and try to explain how satellites work. There's not one person on there that's a scientist. Right. So you have to look at these extremes on how can you bring that all the way back to connect with people that need to make pretty powerful decisions. I mean, we look at this in politics. We look at this in all kinds of arenas. This is interesting with the virus right now for me, because there was no story behind it. There was no, here's what's happening. This is what's going on. It's just been thrown a lot of stuff at everybody and it's panicked everyone. We're used to story. We have the innate ability to want a story. And what is happening? And so therefore, we're looking for that kind of, I don't want to just say leadership, but we're looking for that kind of thing that makes us feel comfortable. And once we start feeling comfortable, there's the first step to persuasion.
Has it always been thus? Because I think you alluded at the beginning of our conversation to something about like these times or like right now. And I'm wondering if you've seen changes in recent years, whether because of the political landscape or whatever, in the willingness of people to be persuaded. Is it getting tougher?
Oh, it's definitely getting tougher because of technology. What's so interesting, and even if I look back in the last 25 years, I can't say that I've seen a time where stopping us in our tracks with this virus has really brought people a little more together versus us, the technology, which is separating us. And it's been interesting to watch in a way that we want to connect now. Before it was like, I don't really want to connect. Now, because you're isolated, you want to connect. And I think the pendulum is swinging back a little bit, because before, technology was just really separating us and it was much harder because attention spans were so short and people just didn't want to deal with it if they didn't have to deal with it. And time was money and we had to hurry up. And now things have slowed down a little bit, which is, I think, great. And I don't know if I've ever seen that in the 25 years of what I've been doing.
That's an interesting observation, because I was thinking in that question even before the pandemic happened. I was looking at what is generally thought to be a serious increasing polarization of opinion in this country. Therefore, I wonder, if people retreat to their positions and they stick there. And I'm just wondering if for that reason, even before the pandemic came upon us, was it getting harder in this political environment, in this social environment, to knock people off of that position a little bit and to persuade them of what you want to persuade them of?
Oh, yeah, I think it was becoming much harder because we're isolated more and more and more. So let's just say, go back to the jury box. You've got 12 people that are sitting there that used to be able to get to a room, and if they're going to deliberate, they're going to sit and talk and do whatever. Well, now everybody just starts looking at their phone. So you've got people that go back in that deliberation room that are going to deliberate, but they may start on their phone first and not really even speak to each other for quite some time, which is something I went through, as believe it or not, was picked as a juror. And to watch that dynamic was more impersonal, and you didn't really get the grit behind the decision versus like, no, I don't think so. And then they go right back to their phone. So it was like, it was very odd in that sense of like, I do think prior to this whole situation that we're in now, technology was splitting people further apart. And I just think there's a correction coming that's very interesting, for sure.
Yeah. Well, let's apply this to the real world in the present. I'm interested, you've done so many high-profile trials, but the specific one I want to talk about is the Cisco intellectual property case, which has been described as the first virtual patent trial. Tell me about that and where your expertise in persuasion came in.
This particular case is a client I've had for quite a few years, and we were very thrown off by the fact that it was supposed to be a jury trial, and they ended up passing it over to an elderly judge. I think he was like 84, 85, and they decided to go ahead, and he said, nope, we're going forward to the bench trial. We're going to do Zoom. And in my world, not necessarily my client's world, this was just another level of advancement because I've been in the business for so long. I mean, I was even got in the business before large format printing was as easily acceptable and quick to get. So I've seen so many transitions through trial. This didn't really faze me, but the one thing that came back to the client was it's going to be more important because the judge is elderly and because we have to keep attention that the visual impact of this is going to be very, very important. So my role was to sit down and really put a tutorial together on the complicated, it was to simplify the complicated facts of routers, firewalls, and switches inside of malware, which is not something most people really enjoy doing, but but I really like it because it's a very complicated process to explain this kind of technology to someone who is elderly. And at the same time, simplifying that down and making ways that he could relate to it, like the switches in a computer work exactly like the switches did in the 50s, where you have something that unplugs and plugs back in. So I tried to find things that he could relate to without offending him, and yet connecting ways that he could understand a firewall is literally that's a fire door that stops things on the other side that are bad. So it takes a long time to simplify that kind of thing. And once you have to understand the technology, but it was very important for this judge to understand what the patents meant and how they applied so that then he could figure out if they infringed or didn't. So that was the front part of my role.
Did the technology, I mean, I assume he had to learn the technology in order to even participate. Not that it's that difficult to get on Zoom these days. What's that?
Yeah, well, that's what we had to teach him that. We taught him that technology with the tutorial. So we had a good tutorial on the front end. And then we had to link, I always call it thread the needle, through all the presentations so we could take him back to what he had learned. And he understood how to connect each of those presentations. So through all the experts, I was very involved in making sure that everything went back to that original tutorial. So he was never lost in the process.
So what happened in that trial?
I'm waiting to hear. I don't know yet. But I think that they finished this week, but I've been off to other cases, and I'm just waiting to hear from my client as to where things are going on that. But I'm assuming that the judge would not come back with an answer on that for quite a few months.
Well, it'll be a little while before this actually airs, so maybe if there is a development in the ensuing months or weeks, I'll make sure and mention that in the podcast. Typically, though, when you're in a courtroom environment, when everyone is there in the room together, are you sitting at the table with the lawyers? Are you present? Advising them?
No, I'm definitely not at the table. Sometimes I'll be in the gallery, but a lot of times I'm not there at all. Back in the day, there were times that I was in the courtroom quite a bit, just in the back, like listening to experts and just trying to figure out did the opening go well. I usually like to be there for closing argument, just for my own personal closure on a project. But there's been multiple times I've been in the courtroom. I was in the courtroom quite a bit on Enron. But I also, there's other times that I'm so busy on the case itself that I'm back in the war room and working on things for their next presentation, for their next witness. So it just really depends on situation.
speaking as someone who, like most people, has probably watched too many lawyer shows, I kind of pictured you sitting there like whispering into the ear of the lawyer as you're going, you know, like reading the room and making changes. And no, they can't do that, huh? They've got to absorb your message and then go in without you with them, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm a small piece of it. They've got the law. They've got everything else going on. But if there's a particular witness that they need me to come in and say, okay, how do we thread our story through another witness on the opposite side? Then they may have me come in and sit and listen to say, okay, just take some notes and figure out how we have to counter that. But there's definitely opening statements. Most of the time I'm there just to see how they're setting up their case on the other side. And then, like I said, closing arguments are my own closure. But yeah, it's not like TV. It's nothing like TV.
Not
as exciting as TV. You know, that's the other thing too. Sometimes it's not as exciting.
It's pretty clear how the distancing of technology in this case and in others can certainly hinder your ability to persuade. Are there ways that it's actually helps persuasion? Are there a positive aspect to technology that can help you?
Well, the biggest positive change that's happened is when we finally got, believe it or not, technology into the courtroom. I mean, there was many years of my career that there was an overhead and with overlays that went into the courtroom. That's been quite a few years ago, but that was such a huge change because now we could do presentations where on my end, I feel like with PowerPoint or Prezi or whatever kind of software people use, you can do little animations that direct people to your point. And that's what persuasive information design is all about, where you could actually take a point and direct them there and get their eyes on something that you want them to hone in on. Because what you see is 70% retention, right? That's why the visuals are so important. And what you hear is only 20. So you want to get to that 90%. So if you're just talking and you don't have that visual impact. So I definitely say the technology, when we got really good high-end technology into the courtroom, was a massive turn in the court system for sure. But that's been quite a few years now.
Well, you have spent a lot of time in the courtroom, but you've also spent a lot of time in the boardroom at the corporate level too. I'm sure that your advice has been very valuable there. I'm just wondering, in those two environments, is it pretty much the same to you as to what it takes to persuade, or is one of those environments tougher than the other?
I would have to say it's pretty much the same, because usually I come in when the stakes are really high. I did some work for a project with Exxon in Alaska, and it wasn't the lawsuit. Everybody says, oh, you worked for Exxon. It's a Valdez. No, it had nothing to do with that. It had to do with some land clear up in Point Thompson. And what needed to be still argued among some committees in Alaska. But it was still the same. I mean, the bottom line is you still have a decision maker, right? I just look at those four things. You always have a decision maker. If you need something from somebody else, who are you and how are you presenting? And then your story and your visuals, like I talked about. But I think the formula stays the same. It's just the subject matter changes up. And so that's why I try to keep my clients consistent on the formula, because otherwise it can be all over the place for different reasons. But you still have a person in front of you, whether, let's say, this is a bench trial, that's a judge. Okay, well, you still have the same process. You just have to present it a little differently. Now you have a jury trial. Now that you've got 12 people, you've got to consider that. So it's the same process. You just have to consider the 12 versus the one. It's really about knowing who your decision maker is. I mean, it's really, I don't think it's any different than trying to persuade my mother to do something. It's like, you know, I need to know who she is, and she can be as tough as a board member. It's really a lot about empathy and compassion and understanding how other people think versus just yourself.
But in a boardroom, there's a hierarchy. You're really, you know, the top person there is the one you really need to convince. And in a jury box, you don't have that hierarchy. You have theoretically 12 equal minds. Maybe they're taking cues from each other. I don't know. But a little bit different there. I mean, how do you appeal to a group of people where there is not a clear hierarchy?
Even if there's a hierarchy, I always try to find, and this is where my intuitive side comes in, I try to find the person who can sell the story. I always try to, like in sales, I mean, even if it's the top person that's at the, let's say you've got a sales team and there's going to be a top head, you've got a sales team going into a corporation and you got a top head person in the room, but you also have three other people on their team. I always look for the person who could possibly sell that story and relate to them versus just going after the top. Because sometimes if you don't connect with that top, you got one shot. And if you don't connect with it, but if you can actually look at everybody else that's sitting there. So when I look at a jury, I look at, okay, who do I think might end up being the foreman on this jury? Over time, you can start to see how that just kind of melts itself in a way. And you know a little bit about the people that are sitting there based on just their background and with social media today. it's not difficult to get a little bit of information. And there's also demographic. There's going to be a very big difference of jurors in Los Angeles versus Ohio. All these considerations have to come into it. But I think that it's not always just going after the lead. But this is where the jury, to me, is most fascinating, because you do have to string all these things together. And you're never, it's very seldom you're going to get everybody, but if you can get the ones to sell your story, that's the ones that I try to go after.
Well, despite the polarization, the irrationality of human beings, the inability to change minds, it sounds like there's some real power, Juliet, in what you're saying here with your Academy of Persuasion. Juliet Huck, thank you so much for enlightening us today about what it takes to persuade people. Thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me and promoting it. I really do. Thanks so much.
That was my conversation with Juliet Huck of the Academy of Persuasion. We're online at www.supplychainbrain.com, where we post a new episode of this podcast for streaming or downloading every Friday. You can also read my Think Tank blog, watch thousands of videos, and access all of our other content, including the digital edition of our magazine. Look for us on Facebook and LinkedIn, and follow us on Twitter, at SCBrain. You can also download or subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts. Got any comments or suggestions on this or any episode? Email me at rbowman@supplychainbrain.com. Stay well, and see you next time.